Welcome to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm Joshua Holland. This week we'll talk to Joan Walsh, my colleague at The Nation, who's also a CNN contributor, about this mad week in Trump land, and also about her piece about how Dems are finally taking state legislative races seriously after long ceding that ground to Republicans and the right. Then we'll be joined by David Kleon. He's a freelance writer in Brooklyn, and we're going to talk a little bit about this new spate of hard right commentators being hired by mainstream publications in an effort to present a diversity of voices, which is laudable, but we'll talk about some of the problems with that. Finally, we'll speak to Mark Bray. He's a scholar at Dartmouth, and he has written about the Antifa movement. And I should say that this interview is one that we taped a while ago, and then I got sick and some things happened. So it's we're playing it now, but it's not fresh. It is, however, the first time that it has appeared on Politics and Reality Radio or anywhere else. But first, what a mad week. This was the week when the Trump was reportedly feeling emboldened. He is replacing all of his kind of like, they weren't good people, but they were the people who were described at various points as the adults in the room. I'm talking about National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, et cetera, et cetera. We'll talk about that with Joan Walsh. But it's hard to keep track of all of the tendrils of the Trump, of Trump's various scandals, right? And one story that I think got a little bit buried this week, and it shouldn't have, is while we were all looking to figure out, you know, what Russia has on Trump, while we've talked endlessly about Trump being Putin's puppet, there were several of these stories this week that suggest that that a seemingly inexplicable reversal in longstanding U.S. policy in the Middle East was either an act of revenge against a longstanding ally for refusing to bail out the Kushner family's deeply indebted real estate company, or a result of a flood of money coming from deep-pocketed autocratic leaders in the Persian Gulf. The short version is this. Qatar is a key ally. It's home to Al Udeid Air Base, which is where our central command and thousands of U.S. military personnel is headquartered. It's an important base for our seemingly endless military campaigns in Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan. And last year, there was this diplomatic clash that resulted in Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and other Sunni-led countries to enact a blockade of Qatar, which the U.S. vehemently opposed. We opposed the blockade until Trump suddenly decided that we've always been at war with East Asia. He condemned Qatar as a sponsor of terrorism, and he threw his support behind the blockade. And that left observers scratching their heads, or you know, wondering what happened. But the Washington Post reported this week that Jared Kushner's father, Charles, confirmed earlier reports that he had sought funding from the Qataris shortly before this sudden about-face. He had anticipated that a deal would be finalized to provide desperately needed financing, and he was, quote, crushed when he learned that the Qataris wouldn't bail him out. And let me quote from The Intercept. After the financing effort failed, Jared Kushner took a sharp turn against Qatar diplomatically, supporting a crushing economic blockade against the country. Then the New York Times revealed this week that George Nader, who is a witness in the Mueller probe, he's talking. And he, quote, worked for more than a year to turn a top Trump fundraiser into an instrument of influence at the White House for the rulers of Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. Those efforts included funneling tens of million dollars in lucrative contracts to a top Trump, and I should say RNC fundraiser, to a company that this guy formed just weeks after the Trump's election. So he forms a company right away and gets $200 million in security contracts from these countries. There's other money coming in. in either scenario, what we're seeing here is that the most powerful country in the world turned on a crucial ally, and an ally that plays a crucial role in our war on terror, for either the regime's personal enrichment or as an act of revenge for not getting a sweetheart deal. And either way, that spells corruption. So The Intercept also reported that Mohammed bin Salman, which is Saudi Arabia's de facto ruler, he recently effected kind of this soft coup. He told UAE Crown Prince Mohammed bin Zayed that he had Jared Kushner, and I quote, in his pocket. Now, I wonder what the MAGA crowd would think of their hero, their America First hero, selling out to a bunch of oil-rich Muslims. It's probably good for their mental health that they don't believe everything that isn't reported by Fox. And with that, let's move on with the show. We're going to take a quick break and then be right back. Stay tuned.
Driving in the road van, he's got to beat the clock to the next town. Road man, driving in the road van, I set up the sound system for the band. Road man, slow it down and you will get that safe and sound. He says no, 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 the show must go on. Road man, driving like a madman, breaking land speed records in the van. Roadman, heat on my policeman, leaving trail of ripped up citations. Roadman, slow it down and you will get there safe and sound. He says no, 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 the show must go on.
I'm still Joshua Holland, and I'm very pleased to welcome Joan Walsh back to the show. Joan is the national affairs correspondent for The Nation and a contributor to CNN. She's also the author of What's the Matter with White People. Joan, welcome back to Politics and Reality Radio.
Thanks for having me, Josh. Great to be with you.
I want to talk to you about a piece you wrote for The Nation this week, but before we dig in, I just need to get your reaction to the kind of mayhem that's dominated White House news this week. And let me just recap for listeners who may have been out of touch for the last day or two. McMaster, who is supposedly one of the adults in the White House, is out. John Bolton's in. Trump fired his top lawyer for Russiagate, John Dowd, who had counseled the president to cooperate with the probe and hold back on attacking Mueller. And in his place, so he's out. In his place is Joseph DiGenova, a wingnut conspiracy theorist who made a name for himself during the Clinton wars, and his wife, Victoria Tonsing, who people will remember for her role in the Monica Lewinsky scandal. He's also talking about ditching John Kelly, the White House chief of staff, and there are reports that he's feeling liberated, unchained, etc. So the writing is on the wall. It's fairly clear he's going to double down attacking his enemies, including Iran, North Korea, the Justice Department, Robert Mueller. And the thing that I find striking about this is that he continues to play to his base, even though it's become abundantly clear that they'll stick with him no matter what he does and everyone else hates him.
They will stick with him. And, you know, they'll stick with him even when he brings on a warmonger like John Bolton. You know, I mean, to me, one of the craziest claims of the left at the end of 2016 before the election was that, you know, Hillary Clinton was the hawk and Trump was the dove. And you know, I had friends try to make that case to me. And now, and you know, follow up by saying, well, the white working class is sick of war, and that's part of why they went for him. Oh, really? Well, the white working class better get used to liking war. And maybe they will if he's waging it, you know, because John Bolton is a complete sharp stick in the eye of every claim he made about bad wars. Iraq was a bad war. He lied and said he opposed it. He really supported it, but he eventually came around, like most sane people, to oppose it. Trump, that is. He can do, as far as we've seen so far, he can do anything. But I do think you've missed a couple of comparable switches, right? Because we also traded Gary Cohn. I don't like him. He's a Goldman Sachs guy. Even though they call him a Democrat, we don't share politics or values too much. But we got Larry Kudlow, again, another TV. He's got a Fox TV lawyer. Now he's got a CNBC economic advisor, right wing. And then we traded, let's not forget, even though it seems like it was so long ago, he fired Rex Tillerson, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, while he was on the toilet, a really nice Trumpian flourish there. And we got Mike Pompeo, torture advocate and Islamophobe, as our Secretary of State, a position that is really all about trying to use diplomacy to avert war, trying to find common ground even with our enemies. So it's like this is the cabinet that he wanted 14 months ago and maybe didn't have either the knowledge or the courage to assemble these maniacs, but he's got them now.
And this is all 6 weeks before a kind of impromptu meeting with North Korea. Whether that happens or not is still an open question, I think. Should we stop trying to find an internal logic to all of this? I mean, is it all kind of a result of presidenting according to what the dolts on Fox and Friends say that morning?
I think that's a lot of it. Yes, I think that's a lot of it. And I think
because it makes no sense otherwise. I mean, it just, you know, there's he's stupid. He's a narcissist. So he just wants to be flattered. There's nothing in terms of political calculus that makes sense here.
No, I don't think so either. You know, a lot of these things are self-contradictory. So, you know, I think the easiest way to understand most of it is he doesn't like people who say no to him. He's been complaining about McMaster pretty much from day one. Remember, he had to get rid of his buddy Mike Flynn, who might be going to prison instead of being National Security Advisor. And he really was mad about that. And started complaining about McMaster right away, that he just didn't like the way he briefed him, and he said no, and he, you know, just didn't flatter him. That turned out, that came to be true about Rex Tillerson. We know it's also true about John Kelly, who could be out the door, and, you know, while we're talking. Trump has floated the notion that, hey, maybe he doesn't need the chief of staff. You know, maybe that guy who's a gatekeeper and is keeping out sometimes even his children, knuckleheads like Corey Lewandowski that he loves to still spend time with, even though he fired him. Why does Kelly have access to his front door? Why can't he just let anybody in who he wants? He's the president. So, you know, it's largely getting rid of ideology aside. And, you know, Gary Cohn hates his whole tariff trade war move. So it's largely throwing aside people who said no to him and bringing in people that, you know, he's made it clear he really vibes with for whatever reason. And so let the games begin.
Yeah, this is scary stuff. I mean, there must be a breaking point for Republicans. I mean, maybe not, but I think the question is, you know, how much damage will be done before we get there? Because Bolton, I mean, this guy is, he was too extreme to be confirmed For the position of ambassador to the UN. He had to be recess appointed by George W. Bush. And his presence around Trump, especially with Trump looking for a distraction from domestic issues, the Mueller investigation, various porn stars coming out and suing him, with Bolton in place, we have greatly increased our chance of getting into a disastrous shooting war on, you know, a spur of the moment kind of impulse. And this is a really dangerous formula. Anyway, let's move on. Joan, yeah, wrote an important piece this week for The Nation, where I should point out I am a contributor. It's titled The 7,383 Seat Strategy. Listeners can check that out at thenation.com. Joan, we're seeing a lot of attention on the upcoming midterms, how they might change the balance of power on Capitol Hill. Lots of energy among Dems and progressives. What's happening at the state level?
I'm really excited by what's happening at the state level, Josh. I think the Democrats have belatedly realized they have to play there. They kind of gave up during the Obama years. My story looks at some of the reasons why. But just as Republicans found themselves locked out of power, losing the House, the Senate, and then the White House in 2009, they jumped into action at the state legislative level, because Democrats, despite losses, despite, you know, what we saw of as the kind of a red tide crossing the country during the Bush years, state houses pretty much stayed disproportionately in Democratic hands. And Republicans began to realize in the 2000s, I mean, it goes back to 2002 in Texas, that they could, for not a lot of money, knock off your, you know, your local state rep, your local state senator, and put in a Republican, and then they would control redistricting. They could redraw the boundaries for their own state races, these same state rep and state senate races, and they also would then control, in 37 states anyway, they control the drawing of congressional districts. So they doubled down, tripled down, whatever the cliche is, sorry, you know, from the Koch brothers to the North Carolina's single Koch brother, Art Pope. They poured millions of dollars into this strategy. And, you know, we all paid attention to what happened election night 2010 in Congress, but not enough people paid attention to what they did at the state house level. So now they control 32 states. They control both houses. And in 25, they have what's called a trifecta, where they also have a Republican governor, which means those states can do, those Republicans can do whatever they want. A lot of it has to do with redistricting. But I also, as I was writing this story, really zeroed in on these same states immediately moved on increased voter ID laws, voter suppression laws, basically, is our shorthand. These states that were taken over by Republicans in 2010, seven out of the 11 states with the highest black vote for Obama in 2008 passed some kind of voter restriction that, you know, hit African Americans hardest. They passed horrible anti-abortion laws, you know, we know about transvaginal ultrasounds and fetal funerals and, you know, attempted six-week abortion bans, on and on and on. They passed anti-labor laws. They passed right-to-work laws, which researchers are now saying actually hurt Democratic turnout in 2016 significantly, and might have helped cost, since we're talking 77,000 votes collectively, right? Have actually helped, you know, kill Hillary Clinton in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. So, you know, as I got deeper into it, I went down deep into a very, very sad, dark well, looking at all the damage they've done apart from gerrymandering. And so what's the good news? The good news is that outside groups, resistance groups, older progressive groups like NARAL and Emily's List, have really started focusing on the opportunities at the state level. And even more important, women have started running for these seats. I was blessed to spend a lot of time in Virginia last year trying to keep myself sane and ignoring Trump's tweets to focus on the resistance. And nobody predicted it, but women flocked to be first-time House of Delegate candidates. And on election night, they won, well, Democrats won 15 seats. 11 of the victors were women. And I believe all but one of them had never run before in her life. So people saw that and saw some of, or took some of the lessons from it. And now we're seeing more of that all over the country.
And that election in Virginia had consequences, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, starting they just lost having a majority. Literally, if there was a tie, they chose the winner by pulling his name out of a ceramic urn, and the GOP incumbent got his seat back. But when they were all sworn in January, the Democrats began to push for Medicaid expansion. And Terry McAuliffe, a former Democratic governor, had been pushing for that since he took office in 2014 and never got more than, I think he got one Republican vote in each House. This time they passed it, at least in the House of Delegates, with, I think, 19 Republican votes. One of the people who voted for it, who had never supported it, was that guy, David Yancey, who had his name pulled out of a ceramic urn. Somebody else who's very conservative and almost lost his seat to a wonderful black minister, Veronica Coleman. She almost beat him. He made a speech on the floor in which he kind of apologized for changing his vote, but said elections have consequences. So we're already seeing these new legislators take on the energy giant there, Dominion, take on criminal justice reform. They're not getting everything passed. They're not getting most things passed. And yet they're finding some points of leverage, and they're finding some frightened Republicans who realize it's actually not playing well at home for them to vote as a block to stop all progress. So, so you're right to remind us of that. It's not just that Virginia inspired other new candidates and inspired other new outside groups. It also is changing lives for hundreds of thousands of Virginians.
And you write that a different kind of candidate is coming forward to challenge incumbents in a lot of these races. Tell me about that, and to what degree the party is embracing these new candidates.
Well, first of all, last year I really focused on the women, but we also saw Lee Carter, a man who was a Democratic Socialist of America activist who ran and also won, but clashed with the party. I think in the party's defense, they would say, wow, we had twice the number of Democratic challengers taking on Republican incumbents than we had in 2015. We were never able to raise, a commensurate amount of money. All of that is true. The flip side of that, though, I think, is that the powers that be tended to look at some of these candidates who won, but were unlikely candidates. Danica Rome, first transgender candidate, she beat the guy who had sponsored their bathroom bill, Bob Marshall. She wasn't expected to win. She had primary opponents that, members in the party quietly supported. A lot of these women who were victorious didn't look like they could win, and so they didn't get a state party support right away. Now, the party will tell you, gradually towards the end, they did come in and help a kind of second wave of them. But really what happened was that amazing outside groups that you've never heard of, a group called 31st Street Swing Left. Swing Left wasn't even supposed to play in the state legislative space. They were established to go after Congress. There's no charter. They don't have to be credentialed. They just, somebody says, I'm a swing left. I'm on 31st Street in Washington, D.C. Come to my meeting. And the people who show up at the meeting are like, hey, there's something really going on in Virginia. So why don't we try to do work on the statehouse level? And so these people poured money as well as canvassing resources into several, candidates who were kind of on the bubble and really pulled them over the line. I was writing closely about a woman named Kelly Fowler, who I thought was magnificent. But when I talked to her in August, she was about to drop out of the race. She had no money. She had found a terrific campaign manager, but she couldn't pay him. And these folks at 31st Street swing left. I've written about this for The Nation, if anybody wants to Google it. They heard from somebody who told somebody who told somebody, hey, Kelly Fowler's going to drop out if you guys don't, if somebody doesn't help. They wrote her a check for, I don't know, $3,000 and got her through. And then the party helped, and then a lot of other groups helped. So it's the party is challenged, and the Virginia party isn't unusual. It's more progressive than some state parties, to be honest with you. A lot of the state parties are into incumbent protection. We can't win the majority if we don't save our minority, but they put lots of money into people who probably don't need it. And they tend to look for men and lawyers, because what they're really looking for is somebody who they're comfortable with, but also somebody who maybe can write a check to their own campaign, right?
Right.
They can write a check. Their law partners can write checks. These ladies who came back from the Women's March all fired up, they didn't necessarily know who was going to write them checks. They couldn't write their own checks. And so, you know, they needed a different kind of help. They eventually got it, but, you know, there's a lot to pay attention to. The diversity of the candidates racially, in terms of their union members and the first social worker, et cetera, they brought out different constituencies as well. And so it really activated a whole new level of Democrat. Maybe they didn't even consider themselves Democrats, but they thrilled to learn about the traffic proposals or the education proposals of that nice, you know, social worker who lives down the street and whose kids go to school with your kids. It just has a little bit of social capital building also that I really loved, where people are getting involved again.
It's remarkable. You know, one thing that I thought was very valuable about your piece is that the Dems lost thousands of legislative seats across the country under Obama. And most commentators tend to use that fact to advance their own ideas of what's wrong with the party. So they'll say, yeah, Dems are in deep water at the state level because they didn't do this thing I want them to do. The reality is that it was a ton of right-wing organizational resources that went into state houses uncountered by progressives and with a Democratic president in the White House. It was super effective. And so now we're finally kind of waking up to this reality. This is so important, not only just for controlling the redistricting process for Congress and being able to enact these kind of barriers that protect your incumbents, but also, you know, so much of social policy, educational policy is determined at the state level. This
exactly.
has a huge impact on people's lives. So maybe this is like the silver lining. You know, I keep looking for silver linings in the age of Trump. It's such a dark time. If we get this kind of realization that we have to contest 6,000, you know, state races every time they come up, and if that is enduring, you know, along with the energy we see, the tendency to turn out we see among Democrats and progressives, you know, maybe that is the silver lining ultimately to Trumpism, is that it wakes the country up to the fact that if you don't participate, well, then you can get a crackpot, you know, reality TV host in the White House appointing John Bolton, and you can have these crazy laws being passed at the state level, 6-week abortion bans, laws to preempt local communities from raising their minimum wages, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, ad infinity.
Exactly. And when you also look at, you know, who the states that were really destroyed the most by these pushes, you do see, you know, Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, North Carolina. These are states that Obama won in 2008 and that Hillary Clinton lost in 2016. I'm not saying there's a straight line between abandoning the state house and to the Republicans, but I can't prove that. I'm not a social scientist, but intuitively it seems right to me that you just had these places where Democrats weren't even contesting anymore, and the party just soft support for the party just kind of went away. It doesn't matter. I'm not turning out. There's nobody to turn out for. So, I close the piece by saying these folks remind me of what Reverend Dr. William Barber says calls repairs of the breach, because also North Carolina is going to be a really big, big fight this year. They've actually managed to recruit candidates for every single state assembly seat and every single state Senate seat, whereas they had like 30-something Republicans go unchallenged in 2014. So they want to be the next Virginia. And so I think I'll spend some time down there looking at what they're doing.
Folks, Jones' piece is titled The 7,383-Seat Strategy. You can check it out at thenation.com. And I just want to note that a very small amount of engagement in state legislative races can have a huge impact. You know, a handful of volunteers, some of these races come down to 20, 30 votes, a handful of volunteers, a couple of dollars. You know, find a state race near you and, you know, see who's running and figure out where you can get involved and help with this effort, because it really is important. Joan, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you, Josh. My pleasure.
Folks, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then come right back.
From the day he was born, he was troubled. He was the thorn in his mother's side. She tried in vain, but he never caused her nothing but shame. He left home the day she died. From the day she was gone, all he wanted was rock and roll porn on the motorbike, shooting up junk.
He was a low-down, cheap little punk,
taking everyone for a ride. When Eddie said he didn't like his head, he knew he was a no-good kid. But then he fell in the line with a switchblade knife.
What a guy!
And I did.
Everybody shoved him. I very nearly loved him. I said, hey, listen to me. Stay sane inside insanity. But he locked the door and threw away the key.
But he must have been drawn into something, making him warn me in a note which reads,
what did it say? What did it say? I'm out of my head. Oh, hurry, or I may be dead. They mustn't carry out their evil deeds.
Yeah! When Eddie said he didn't like his head, he knew he wasn't a good kid. But when he threatened your life with a switchblade knife,
what a gosh!
And I did. No good kid, but then he threatened your life with a switchblade knife.
What a god!
Makes you cry.
And I did.
Welcome back to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm still Joshua Holland. I'm joined now by David Kleon. David is a freelance writer in Brooklyn. He was actually going on a tear about something earlier today that was bothering me, and I figured I'd get him on the show and we could talk a little bit about what's going on. David, you should follow him on Twitter, by the way. It's at David Kleon. David, welcome to Politics and Reality Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for taking the time. So, okay, the latest kind of wig nut to be hired by a mainstream publication is Kevin Williamson of the National Review. He was hired this week by The Atlantic. And this follows an effort to kind of bring a bunch of conservative voices on at the New York Times, elsewhere. And what's going on is that the quality of the writers are being criticized, and then various editors seem to be getting their backs up, getting very defensive about these things and kind of portraying the opposition to them as a manifestation of the liberal bubble. These people are being portrayed as kind of dissenting voices from the center left consensus in the mainstream press. That's the way it's being portrayed. David, is that wrong? I mean, what disqualifies Kevin Williamson from writing for The Atlantic?
Well, nothing, apparently. I mean, you know, so it's interesting, the genesis of this, and you mentioned the New York Times, I think. The New York Times, and I want to just be clear, we're talking about their opinion section here. The yes. paper as a whole was more complicated. But the New York Times opinion section last year was taken over by James Bennett, who was the longtime editor-in-chief of The Atlantic. And The Atlantic is currently run by Jeff Goldberg, and I believe they're friends and obviously have worked together for a long time. Goldberg, of course, has been around a while and is probably most famous for his reporting in the run-up to the Iraq War 15 years ago. For the New Yorker, where he, you know, put out a long article strongly suggesting that Saddam was building, had WMD programs and possible al-Qaeda links, all of which has since been discredited, none of which has stopped Jeff Goldberg from his relentless advance in media. So it's interesting to compare Bennett to Goldberg here. Bennett, of course, has had statements leaked to the Huffington Post's Ashley Feinberg by, I guess, dissident New York Times staffers. And so we have a somewhat clearer idea of his thinking about all this. And, you know, it is kind of what you're talking about, this kind of mealy-mouthed, you know, we have to get liberals outside their bubble. We have to... you know, we have to expose them to different perspectives, and that seems to account for why he brought on the trollish Bret Stephens from the Wall Street Journal. And Stephens has said some really obnoxious things, and really everything he says is obnoxious, but you get the sense that he's just a lifelong campus conservative who's just trying to troll the lib. Williamson is a longtime National Review contributor, and in the last year or two, I guess he's cast himself as a never Trump voice. And he's written a number of pieces castigating Trump supporters, which is what Stevens did too. And is, you know, and it's what David Frum and Jennifer Rubin and other often neoconservative figures from the Bush era did. And it's a good way to kind of win respectability among liberals in the Trump era. And it's not just his positions that are disturbing. It's a history of kind of bullying and, frankly, cruel and callous statements. You get the sense that he's not just trying to annoy liberals, but actually trying to shock and disturb them when he says things like, for instance, that women who seek abortion should be hanged, which is something he tweeted, or when he says that... being transgender is a mental illness and describes the transgender actress Laverne Cox as being an effigy of a man, I think, or something like that.
I'll just say that he has this history of making extremely over-the-top these comments about that you mentioned. He called a black child a monkey in a tweet. He wrote a column about Bernie Sanders where he said that he's leading a national socialist movement. The thing that I find striking is that it's not just that these are offensive comments, it's that the opinions he expresses are completely banal. You know, the idea is that, oh, we'll get fresh voices onto the pages of these opinion pages on these magazines, these publications, and that will shake everybody up and give people a new way of thinking about it. But the quality of the writers that they're bringing out, this is certainly true with Bret Stephens, who's a climate change denier. It's certainly true for Kevin Williamson. These are voices that we can get on conservative Twitter, in any Breitbart thread. It's not, they're not offering anything in terms of, you know, these are not fresh voices offering different opinions. It's really standard boilerplate right-wing agitprop.
It speaks, I think, Vox's Dylan Matthews had a tweet today making a really good point about this. It speaks to this sort of needle that they try to thread in mainstream media, where you have this mostly liberal, these mostly liberal publications catering to a mostly liberal readership, and they feel pressured to have conservative voices. And at the same time, you know, they correctly identify Trump with just kind of overt bigotry and his supporters with overt bigotry, and they don't want to publish overt bigotry. So they're kind of reduced to getting this niche that suddenly becomes a very lucrative niche, a racket, I would say, of never Trump conservatives. But the problem is, even when you're down to that, it's really hard to find people who haven't been flirting with bigotry their whole lives, because that's what the conservative movement has been.
David, I think that this also reflects, you know, asymmetric polarization, because the bottom line is that this is a supply problem. It's not a demand problem. I understand wanting to bring in diverse voices. I understand wanting to bring in a conservative voice. And yet they're looking for people who are conservatives who don't have this kind of tawdry history of extremist rhetoric, and they're not able to find them. So you have Barry Weiss. When they don't
Barry
have
Weiss
that kind of problem, they have other problems. Right. But Barry Weiss has that very big issue, which is that she tried to get critics of Israel fired from their academic jobs, and then has devoted most of her time to decrying campus PC and no platforming people, et cetera, et cetera. The bottom line is that, you know, it would be great to find intelligent, fresh, non-racist voices on the right to bring in and mix up with these other columnists, but they don't exist, and when they do exist, then they no longer are identified as being on the right. And this is a key point, because you do have certain voices like this. You mentioned David Frum, for example. He's been expelled from the conservative movement and is no longer considered a conservative because of his because he is a thoughtful and non-extreme person. I don't want to give him too much credit because of the Iraq War, but you understand what I'm saying.
I do. Or the other example I often bring up of a well-known conservative intellectual who I have many issues with, but I have a baseline of respect for, is probably Ross Douthat at the New York Times, who predates Bennett, but who, you know, is pretty straightforward that the reason he's a conservative is because he's a deeply religious Catholic who wants to reject the sexual revolution, which I find baffling, but, you know, that's the bias he goes in with. And then with that as his baseline assumption, he seems to engage in good faith with what liberal and leftist writers are actually saying. And he seems to be an independent thinker. And, you know, he does sometimes have original or provocative ideas. Even when I feel like I'm being trolled by him, I don't feel insulted in the way that I do when I read a Bret Stephens column, or insulted and deeply offended in the way that I do when I read anything by Kevin Williamson.
Yeah, it's a supply problem. It is a supply problem. There's too many publications that would like to add a fresh and original conservative voice without a lot of very ugly baggage, and there just aren't that many to go around. David Cleon, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to join us. I really do appreciate it, and especially for doing it on last minute.
No problem. Anytime.
Folks, follow David on Twitter at David Cleon. Stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then be right back.
Feel the get grip
Welcome back. I'm still Joshua Holland. This week, Richard Spencer, the alt-right, neo-fascist provocateur, suspended his Trigger the Libs on College Campuses tour and cited Antifa violence for his decision to do so. Natasha Leonard wrote a piece in The Intercept crediting Antifa's tactics. Well, she didn't say that fighting them in the streets was what did the trick, but it was implied in the piece. I wrote a piece for The Nation, which you can check out at thenation.com, arguing that it was Antifa's other tactics, namely outing white supremacists, finding them and outing them, letting their employers know who they are, denying them a venue that is more effective. Anyway, I found this old interview that I had recorded with Mark Bray last year. A variety of circumstances prevented me from airing it at the time, and I apologize to Mark Bray, but here it is. Now by Mark Bray, he's a lecturer at Dartmouth, and he's the author of Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook. Mark, welcome to Politics and Reality Radio.
Thanks so much for having me.
During this whole recent uprising of white supremacy and reactions to white supremacy, I think Antifa has been portrayed as an organization that, or a loosely affiliated network, I should say, that's primarily engaged in physically confronting neo-fascists, neo-Nazis. Is that an accurate portrayal?
No, I mean, what ends up happening with so much of politics is the media focuses on their sort of distant interpretation of what is publicly visible. It's important to understand that Antifa politics, Antifa methods are designed to stop white supremacists, neo-Nazis, fascists, and so forth as easily as possible, right? So a lot of what they do, the vast majority of their activities are nonviolent. They function in some ways similar to private investigators where they track neo-Nazi organizing across multiple social media platforms in person. You know, there's a lot of it is doxing, which is a term for publicly disclosing personal information about someone, such as their occupation or address, in an effort to tell people's neighbors that they have a neo-Nazi living down the street, tell employers that they're employing white supremacists. And we can see after Charlottesville that a lot of the repercussions that some of these khaki-wearing, tiki torch white supremacists faced were from their employers firing them, their families repudiating what they do. And what ends up happening is the self-defense aspect is sort of a last line of recourse that ends up getting a lot of attention when it spills out into the streets.
Now, I've covered various anarchist movements in the past. Do you not think that they have some responsibility for the coverage, the tone of the coverage as it is? And let me put it to you this way. In my experience, there is a deep and abiding distrust of the media among anarchist groups. And what that does is that they end up not engaging in media, in media outreach. They tend to not talk to reporters. They don't trust reporters. They think that they're part of this corrupt institutions. How does that hinder this movement in terms of what is ultimately portrayed on screen?
Right. That's a great question. And it is true that a lot of anarchists and similar kinds of radicals are distrustful of the media. I think, you know, as you would probably agree to, you know, at least to some extent with justification with certain major corporate outlets, which by virtue of their organizational and economic structures tend to portray politics in a certain way. More specifically, though, within the anti-fascist movement, there's sort of a range of different tendencies, and that's sort of important to parse apart. What we've mostly been focusing on in the media are the sort of self-described Antifa groups, which tend to be small, closed groups that really focus on security culture in anonymity in order to prevent a backlash from either law enforcement or neo-Nazis. There are also other kind of groups affiliated with unions, affiliated with other kinds of forms of collective community empowerment that are more open-faced. For example, even Rose City Antifa in Portland, Oregon is an example of an Antifa group that will talk to the press. It kind of varies, but ultimately gets back to the point that for many anti-fascists, the immediate goal is to stop fascist organizing and not necessarily to become a popular mass movement. So within anti-fascism, there are sort of more mass organizing tendencies, and then there are more focused on sort of small group activities tendencies. And of course, they both have their different strengths and weaknesses.
Are there divides within this movement about what is the best, about the practical value of violence versus nonviolence?
Well, there has been a debate in anti-fascist circles in countries around the world stretching back decades about the role of community organizing, the role of sort of inoculating large sectors of the population against the white supremacist and fascist message of these groups and others that focus on direct action tactics to stop them. And there are debates on how much a group should lean one way or the other. And there are groups now and in the past that exist all across that spectrum. And so, you know, that is kind of the complexity with any kind of political movement. You know, you're always going to get debates and differences and ranges of opinion.
Now, it when you talk to Antifa people, they'll tell you that they're defending the larger left often, and want to deprive fascist, neo-fascist, white supremacists of a platform, and that seems fairly. That seems like a worthy goal or a lofty goal. But when you get into, for example, you mentioned Rose City Antifa, they threatened a parade because a local Republican party was going to participate. I don't know if it was an Antifa group, but certainly college left, whatever you want to call them. They tried to do a platform, Charles Murray. So you get into this kind of difficulty distinguishing between fascists and neo-Nazis and white supremacists and just kind of right-wingers. Is that a problem for this movement?
That's a good question. I think that certainly one thing to clarify is that sort of the focus on kind of far-right speakers on campus is sort of a new wrinkle in the anti-fascist playbook. And going back decades, more of the focus was on organized groups. One exception was David Irving, the Holocaust denier, who has been targeted by anti-fascists for a long time for his Holocaust denial presentations. But in part, he was targeted because these events turned into sort of organizing hubs for local white supremacists and neo-Nazis. Part of the argument also with shutting down figures like Milo Yiannopoulos or Ann Coulter is also the notion that these do create, to some extent, spaces for alt-right gatherings to occur officially, unofficially. The question, I think, also should be looked at empirically based on the historical record, where one would think that if there were an intense slippery slope from going from, you know, neo-Nazis to the far right, to the center, et cetera, then that probably, I would imagine, would have happened. But I don't really know of significant examples of it sort of really sliding down. Usually what happens is once far right groups are shut down locally, the anti-fascist group responsible kind of dissolves and the individuals focus on other kind of left organizing. You know, I'm not here. My job in this is not to say who should or should not be no platform. That's up to anti-fascist groups to decide, and reasonable people can debate that kind of thing. But I think that there is certainly a connection that we can see between, like, Charles Murray's claims that, you know, black people have some sort of inferiority through his book and so forth, the bell curve, and sort of white power politics.
Well, I mean, I certainly agree that there's a connection, but Charles Murray is, you know, he's a professor, right? He's a published guy. And the Republican Party in Portland, that's the mainstream Republican Party. And I think that, you know, yes, it is up to individual groups whether to no platform these kinds of speakers, but it rebounds on the entire left, because we have to deal with this inaccurate, false equivalence in terms of violence, right? In reality, since the end of the Vietnam War era, the hard right, the far right, has had a near monopoly on political violence, serious political violence, right, in this country. I mean, there used to be, if you look in the 60s and 70s, that wasn't the case. But since then, with the rise of the militia movement, et cetera, and yet there is this narrative that both sides have these extreme wings that are doing, that are, you know, set, pent on violence. And I think that hurts progressives across the board. You respond.
Sure. Yeah. Well, to take the before addressing the latter point, to go back to sort of Murray and his credentials, you know, people in his field have been pretty clear that his arguments are thoroughly discredited. And yes. So while he may have a degree, you know, like we should also bear in mind that universities bear some responsibility to promote the legitimate scholarship in their field. And if some people have put on social media, like, you know, you wouldn't bring in like a flat earther to talk to the geography department kind of thing. So that is sort of another element of it. It's not just a matter of disagreements, but there is a certain, at least minimal, you know, element of truth in this. Now, we're getting back to the question of political violence on the left and the right and how that rebounds outward. You know, it's important also to understand that, you know, agree or disagree with anti-fascists, they are predominantly revolutionary leftists, socialists, anarchists, and communists who are trying to sort of mobilize for a revolutionary rupture rather than working through the institutions of government. And that is a fundamental disconnect with sort of your progressive left. And, you know, agree or disagree, there's going to be a tension there, and there always has, and it comes up and it flares up in different times and places. And most of these anti-fascists are just not especially interested in what the center thinks about the progressive left. So, you know, that's just the way it is.
Is it a youth movement?
I think it is largely young, and I think that's true of most radical social movements, though it does seem to be more diverse than the general portrayal of it. And I would also add that, you know, the question is not only what do Antifa groups think, but as you alluded to with the campus discussion, is also the question of how much the sort of no platform angle, how much the question of, you know, direct action plays into broader left perspectives on how to deal with the far right. And I think it's been influential, for better or worse, depending on your perspective, it's been influential beyond its numbers.
I really appreciate you taking the time. I believe we are out of time, but thank you so much for speaking with me today. I really do appreciate it.
Been a pleasure. Take care.
Folks, Mark Bray's book is called Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook. I'd also like to thank Joan Walsh and David Kleon. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall. You can subscribe to the show at Podbean or SoundCloud or iTunes or wherever else you can get your podcasts. You can send an email griping about the show to politicsandreality@gmail.com. I'd like to thank the good folks at Crooks and Liars, Smirking Chimp, and Hullabaloo for letting me host the show at their respective joints. Of course, I would like to thank all of you fine people for tuning in this week. Have a terrific week. That there's someone who cares is me. Who wants your love desperately?